Hi, I'm Sunny Dean.
And I'm Scott Drakeford.
And this is the Publishing Rodeo Podcast. In 2022, we both launched debut novels in the same genre with the same publisher in the same year. But despite having very similar starts, our books and subsequently each of our careers went in very different directions.
That pattern repeats itself throughout the industry over and over. Why do some books succeed while others seem to be dead on arrival?
In this podcast, we aim to answer those questions and many more, along with how to build and maintain an author career.
Everyone signing a contract deserves to know what they're really signing up for. In an industry that loves its secrets, we'll be sharing real details from real people. We'll cover the gamut of life as a Big Five published author, from agents to publishing contracts, finances, and more.
I should just get going. It's probably just a conversational one. So really belated welcome to Publishing Rodeo as you catch us in the middle of a conversation because I hit record at random and don't care. I don't know when we'll air this. This is the first one we've recorded since Worldcon, although we have at least one or two, I think, that are recorded but not released because Matt Holland is the busiest man on God's green earth.
Has that one still not gone?
He's not had the time.
Yeah.
It's fine. Like, there's literally no rush, so I don't care. Yeah, so we've not really recorded in a long time. And I think, as we were just kind of talking about, that's because it felt really important to kind of start the conversation and have the conversation. And now I've had it. And I kind of just want to write books and actually get paid again. I'm writing more than I've ever written. I've got 4 projects to maybe hand in this calendar year. And it just doesn't feel like anything is moving, which is probably the thing I was going to talk about today, which is the issue of momentum in publishing and your publishing career, and whether it's a real thing. I think it is, but not for readers. Like, readers are not really bothered by a 3 or 4 year gap. I think your publisher is.
Yeah,
I think there's an element where, like, in 3 or 4 years, you might have had 6 editors come and go. You might, people don't know who you are anymore. You've been replaced by literally like 40 other books in the interim. That's the part that's always really scary.
I do wonder, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but I do wonder something we should ask an editor, or maybe multiple editors, is how, I'm going to message Robert right now. How far do expenses carry on a P&L, right? So when you sign your deal for 300, how long does that count against their profits, right? I would imagine if they're doing it right, I would imagine it is there forever and they account on a per book or per deal basis. But if they're accounting on a strictly per year basis, and they only look backward, you know, 1 or 2 years when they're making decisions, that loss could have already been discounted, right, against whatever gains they had that year, and may not have the same leverage. Maybe you know.
I don't know. I think that's a question. So we actually had an editor, a couple of editors at Worldcon, say that they were interested in coming on to fill in the gaps and correct some things that they thought were not quite right. So we will hope to have them on, at least do 2 or 3 more episodes, because it's just a few things that I wanted to wrap up. But I guess I also wanted to do like a kind of catch up where we've been, what we've been doing, what's happened to the guests who've come. So I guess the first thing is, like, thank you to everyone who did nominate us for the for an award we definitely did not deserve and thankfully did not win. So I didn't have to go on stage.
And shame on you to all the finalist ballots, or whatever they call it, that didn't vote for us. So, how does that work? I don't know even who does that, but you should feel very sorry.
So Worldcon is good. So there's like 2 sides to Worldcon. There's like the side where all the readers are going to get signed copies of books and attend panels, and that's fine and it's really good. And then there's the other side, like another con happening simultaneously, and it's just authors going from party to party to party to party for 4 days. I don't know if you talked to like Clay or JT or Shaylin about this, but they were basically out from like 6 a.m. to like 3 p.m. kind of. And that was good. I didn't enjoy it as much as I could have done because the Hugos was hanging over me. I think if I had one defining thing that I learned from Worldcon. It's that I don't ever want to be on their nominee list again, because everything and it was stressful start to finish. It just felt like I was talking to my editor about this. It felt, you know, it just feels like there's a sword, because she was up for nominations too. It feels like there's like a sword hanging over you. Like you don't know what's going to happen. You know, in the ceremony itself, they had like some technical issues that meant like sometimes some of the nominees were played a few times. So people were just kind of like sat on the edge of their seat, really stressed.
Because they care about getting a Hugo that much? Is that what you're saying?
No, because they're all like introverts. They don't want to go up on stage and have to give a speech.
That's hilarious. We have an industry full of people who are yes. like terribly afraid of getting up on stage to accept an award. That's amazing. Like, who set this up? If all these people are just dreading this process,
some people why enjoy do we have this process? The not knowing is scary. In that, I think I was actually more relaxed than most people, because I knew from the moment I came to the pre-reception, I was like 99% sure we hadn't won. And the reason for that is because they'd forgotten my name off the list on the reception. And I thought, if we'd won, they would not have forgotten our name.
Yeah. You were up for the Astounding as well, right?
Yeah. Better. I did better in the Astounding than we did in... Well, like we were dead last for the podcast.
Were we really?
There were actually two podcasts that had more votes than us, but they were excluded because they were professionals, so they weren't allowed on the list. So I was really grateful, because I was thinking, oh, cool, you know, we're going to get to go to Loser's Party. There's no Loser's Party anymore, Scott. It's just an after party.
Oh, shit.
Because people get sad about being called a loser or something, I think. I don't know, it's apparently loaded. But yeah, my whole takeaway from this, I could have spent like this 2 hours probably in the pub and would have been less stressed and happier. So I think in future I would turn down nominations even if we were lucky enough to get them again. Because I don't value getting an award as much as sales.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Why would you?
There's only one formal event at Worldcon, and it's the Hugo Awards. So I'm going to try and plan like a massive fucking party for the next Worldcon, which is like a formal event that everyone can go to. And I think that would be loads of fun, and we can wear ridiculous clothes and it'd be great. Right. Anyway, other non-Worldcon related catch up, because there were things I wanted to catch up on. One was that, you know, we talked about doing the author data project and people were really positive about this, but we ended up looking into it and finding out it was so much work that we thought it would be easier to collaborate with Dr. Carrie Prey. Dr. Carrie has been very unwell this past year. If any of you are on kind of Twitter still or Blue Sky, you can, I don't know if she's on Blue Sky, you can have a look at her Twitter and she's kind of got updates about it. She had a stroke, among other things. So that's not going forward either. And I was also kind of reflecting on how there are less of us out of all the authors we've talked to. There are less of us who are agented now than at the start of this podcast.
Not even just with publishing deals, right? But just straight up agented.
Yeah. Less of us agented, less of us in contract. The people who are still doing well, like Nick Binge, is doing really well. He's got like a big buzzy film thing going on with his books, and he travels and goes to panels. He was doing well to start with, so he's still doing well. You know, I'm doing okay, and I was doing okay to start with, aside from my lack of momentum. But yeah.
I'm curious about you having said you have four things you might turn in. I know the two. And I know the other third whip. No, I know.
Yeah, you do. Novels. Yeah.
I guess we don't have to talk.
No, it's fine. That's the two novels that still need editing, which are, I've done a hand in, but need another hand in, a novella, and then Mystery Project, which cannot be named as yet, but is not anything related to the others.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited for several, but I'm excited for that one. I liked that opening scene. Have you written more than that opening scene for Mystery Project?
Oh no, that's a different Mystery Project.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the sci-fi that you shared that opening scene.
Oh no, that I hope that will be next, the pitch for next contract, but we'll see.
I like that one.
Yeah, that was fun. But anyway, how much you talk about your projects ongoing is up to you. But
I am curious, before we get to that, why a novella? What's the deal with the novella?
It sat on my computer, half written for about 5 years. I need to finish it. I'm now in a position where I can get someone to publish it, because I can try and send it to Tor.com through Tor. And to be honest, I need the money, because like any amount of money I can get, whether I'm doing other projects, just stuff is dragged out for so long. And it's not like we're going to go broke, but it's more like I might have to live off my partner for a bit, which I hate. He doesn't mind, but I mind.
I mean, money's a real thing.
It is, yeah. And every time I talk to my editors about the books, they're all like, don't worry, the books can take as long as they take. They just need to be ready. And it's like, no, they can't take as long as they take because I run out of fucking money. Like, it's not, I don't care if they're slightly less good, just release them. They'll be good enough, you know, fucking hell.
that is my biggest, one of my biggest frustrations with the industry is that the people in the industry really are, besides disposable, they are treated as less than professionals, right? And as less than full-time professionals, where it's almost assumed that you just shouldn't count on making money, you shouldn't count on making livable money, at least from publishing, when the economics of any of these deals are actually quite good. You know, like if you look at the money produced by a book like Book Eaters that sells however many copies it's sold, I don't want to quote a wrong number, but over 100,000, right?
Well, I mean, across the world, I think last time we checked in, there were about 75,000 print copies in the US.
Sure, but regardless of the format, over 100,000 copies sold of any given format means that there's a good chunk of money out there somewhere going to various parties, the publisher, distributors, booksellers, and then finally you. So the money's there. People are buying books. People are buying your books. But the industry isn't set up in a way to, A, have enough money flowing back to the author, in my opinion. And like you're talking about, the timelines and delays that happen on... obviously happen on the author side as well, but delays that happen on the publisher side and on that publisher author coordination aspect really fuck over the economics of trying to make a living as an author. Yeah, anyway, you asked about what I've got going on. I don't really have much to report that's reliable. I can say, I suppose, that I am working on a deal for UK rights that I am extremely excited about. And that's just the verbal agreement or verbal arrangement stage at this point. So nothing set, but I think it's reliable. And the IR series may have a bit of a revival, which I've been working toward for years and years and haven't given up on that, and that's a big part of why actually book two is only coming out now in November instead having it could have come out last year. It was ready in time that it could have come out sooner than a year after Rise of the Mage, but various things happened and I wanted to try to play. I didn't want to give up on this series. And I'd be happy to share details when I have those details.
I mean, but you can possibly talk about how you went with a smaller publisher for Rise of the Mages.
Yeah.
We talked a lot about not accepting those deals when you might.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's a good point. So one of the things that I think I've been dragged on Reddit for, among probably other places, is saying don't sign a small deal. That's not worth it, and you're gonna get screwed because the publisher doesn't have a financial reason to care about you, etc., etc. Which I still think is a decent rule of thumb, right? Signing a deal for $30,000, like I did, probably means that you're not gonna make livable money. That said, you know, in my situation, it wasn't a situation in which I wanted just to sign a foreign rights deal. You know, Tor didn't use my UK or any foreign rights. I signed for World English, so I guess they didn't have my other rights. But they didn't utilize my UK rights. They were shipping, I think, mostly via Amazon over to the UK. I think you could order my book and ebook and hardcover and get it there. But they didn't like produce it. They didn't license the rights to Tor UK or any other publisher. They just kind of sat on them. They were very cool to give those back after a number of years, you know, when my agent asked for them. So kudos to Tor and thank you. But the other option I could have gone for is like maybe a $5,000 per book deal. If I was lucky, maybe like $2,000, something like that, right? Like that's a typical UK debut deal. If I was lucky, I probably would have been able to sign that. Instead, I'm looking at going with a newer, smaller publisher because I believe they are incentivized to succeed, right? In a way that well-established traditional publishers are not.
Yeah, and
because they have,
we will hopefully go into it more at some stage, but they have a very unusual rights division where basically authors keep their ebook, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, that's all negotiable, and I'm not actually sure how I'm going to structure that, but yes.
You're yeah, right. Certainly it's a thing for some authors, which I think is really, really interesting, really promising for the future.
Cool thing is they figured out, you're totally fine. They figured out how to make good money for themselves without just sitting on rights and parasitizing, I suppose, on ebook rights and things like that. So, and audiobook. So it's a really good situation all around. I do hope to be able to share more details because I think it is cool and something that should be publicized.
I have to say that Reddit stuff actually really, really got under my skin. And I think it, it just came at the wrong time, I think, when I was really kind of in post-con slump and feeling like I'd run out of things to say and feeling simultaneously like I was better known for my podcast than my writing, but also that the podcast was winding down and I was kind of... But yeah, it bugged me because it reminded me, there was a TikToker who talked about how books kind of go through these cycles, and I can't remember their name, but I'm pretty sure they use they, them pronouns. But they were talking about how when books come out, there's an initial burst of hype and buzz and people are excited and they're interested. And then at some point, there's a second wave of feedback, which comes from all the people who didn't like the book, and it just feels like a kind of wall of negative reviews. And then the next group of people discover the book, and that starts over again, albeit usually smaller, so that you get these kind of waves of discovery followed by waves of pushback. And I think we had a very big wave of discovery, of people going, oh my God, someone's talking about anything at all related to publishing, and then all the criticism and feedback started to come in, and that we are probably fairly unpopular with certain sections of the internet. And it just frustrated me because I feel like people have lost the ability to talk about nuance, where if I say, like, you know, these are factors which contribute to success, but nothing's a given, blah, 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 and everyone's hot take from that is, if you don't have these magic three tricks, you will die in a fire kind of spin. I always fall for this. I always think if I can just explain enough, someone will understand, and like the kind of the gradation of nuance there, and people don't.
There was somebody that was saying that I, in particular, I like to look at things in a pretty black and white manner. And another person said something about like me being borderline allergic to facts. And it's like, look, man, when you don't have industry-wide data to look at, and you don't have every author out there telling you what their deal looks like, what their actual experience in the industry looks like, all you can operate off of is the stories that you do hear and the anecdotal data that you do gather, through a podcast like this, through talking to published authors. Whatever. And the experience is going to vary, right? Because you've got people, I know we've had comments from people saying like, oh, in my Discord, I'm in a Discord full of published authors and they haven't had an experience anything like this. And come to find out, it's this Discord full of people who got enormous deals and were lead titles for their publisher and whatever else, right? Or they're in a completely different sector, you know, romantasy, YA, whatever, that's booming. So it's always possible to have a very different experience from somebody else in the exact same industry. But yeah, we're doing the best we can with the info we've got. You don't have to listen. We're not getting paid for this. We just show up. We're trying to help anybody we can as we work through our own mental health issues on the show.
I also think that I don't really feel like I've seen anything which has changed my mind significantly. I feel like I keep meeting authors who are in the middle of going through what I'll call the meat grinder, which is the midlist meat grinder, where they don't yet know that they're about to become paste, and you can see all the warning signs. And, you know, I can look at it just on my assessment and be like, you know, I'm looking at their kind of their Goodreads interactions or Edelweiss, that, you know, the publicity or lack of it. You can kind of read the writing on the wall sometimes, and it still happens, and there are still people unaware of it. And I think people are allergic to discussing it in a lot of ways. We like to think that our lives are like stories, that we have an arc, that things work out if we try hard enough. And the only thing I've changed my mind slightly on is I do feel like I've come around a bit to Ed Wilson's point of view about when he was saying that not that authors shouldn't accept big advances, but some publishers shouldn't be giving unachievable ones. I do actually think that's probably true now, because I think there have been some books lately that have received fucking stupid advances. And I don't think the books are going to do as well. They cannot do as well as, you know, they were just a victim of like the hype vicious cycle. And yes, the author will walk away with a lot of money, but they probably won't have a career left, and the publisher will be worse off, and then maybe less likely to spend money on other things. Just
my only counter to that: say a book takes a midlist deal, or even just a minor lead deal, right, instead of a mega lead deal. How does that help? I don't understand how that improves that.
No, outcome. No, it doesn't. I think my flip side to it is that there is a minimum amount that just doesn't work. You know, and I wish that a debut author wasn't getting 2 million, and I wish a debut author wasn't getting 2 grand. And
I mean, as a system, as an ecosystem, I absolutely agree. I think it's a very flawed system, right? And that failed book getting 2 million for no good reason, in my opinion, right? And it keeps happening. The books getting huge amounts and then flopping absolutely hurts the system, hurts the other people in the system, especially the person getting 2 grand or 10 grand or whatever for their book. I just don't think it hurts that book. If I had an option to take $500,000 for a book versus $100,000, there is no scenario which I think it makes sense for me to take 100 versus 500,000, unless I have huge contractual guarantees from a very, very good company. Like, I could see taking 100 grand if I'm getting like insane royalties and I have guarantees for like, you know, 10,000 arcs going out to all these specific people and places, and I have like boxes and they have contractual obligations to get me like certain audio and foreign rights deals, or else those rights revert almost immediately. I can see scenarios in which contractual obligations make sense, but just money to money, I see no scenario in which I think it is appropriate or at least beneficial to that author and even that book to take less money. The book that gets more money is always going to get richer.
No, I generally agree. You know, if someone came to me and said, oh, we're going to give you a 2 million advance, I'd be like, well, fine, I'll sign it. Like, it might be the end of my career, but I will still sign it because there might never be any more. And that's just how, you know, hybrid and self-publishing is a thing. Small press is a thing. If there's no career beyond that, fine. But I do think it is irresponsible for a publisher to do stuff like that. And I think that's...
For sure. It's irresponsible of the publisher, but it's irresponsible of the agent to not have their clients sign that. Because if you sign for 200 grand and the book flops, your career is still dead. If you sign for 20 grand and you flop, your career is still dead.
But even when they do well, I feel like... I mean, this comes back to momentum. I feel like I've seen a lot of authors recently. In fact, when I previous editors, who now is with a different publisher, sent me a book to blurb recently. And I thought, oh, right, I know this author. You know, they had quite a splashy debut back in the day. I think they're a good author. So I accepted the book to read. And I went and kind of looked them up on Goodreads. And I was like, okay, this person's been writing for almost a decade, more than, with it's kind of quite a few books out. And every single book has less ratings than the previous one on Goodreads. You know, even with like a decent advance and a fairly splashy release, and their career is still kind of like, are they still making money? Probably, because they have enough of a backlog to do it. But I feel like I see a lot of that. Even when you do everything right and you have a degree of longevity, because a decade plus is frankly a long time to be in publishing as an author, you know, it's still really hard, and it frightens me how often that's the case. And I think about that a lot in terms of like, actually, I think it does matter how my next book performs. And I know we've talked to Richard about this, where he talks about how your next book contract, it feels like, I think he called it like more like a stay of execution. It's not you're climbing one rung in the ladder. It's more like you just bailed out another bucket of water, but the ship's still sinking. The ship is always sinking. You will eventually be sunk. And in that context, that's why I would always sign a massive deal, even if I thought it was fucking irresponsible and was just going to torch my career, because the house is always on fire, and it's just a question how quickly it burns and what you get out of it before it goes down.
Exactly. Exactly. And so I think we are actually on the same page and saying more or less the same thing. I think maybe the one pitfall there is, like, if you sign a big deal, you may psychologically trap yourself, and your publisher might actually trap you in that then failing trajectory, mm-hmm. right? I guess. Mm-hmm. So maybe you do well on the first book because you got paid up front anyway. But, you know, even though you're getting maybe a smaller deal, you're still getting a deal on the next deal, probably, because your book sold, you know, never mind that it flopped financially, it still sold. So you're probably still getting a deal, which is better than even a quote unquote semi-successful midlist debut would be getting, right? Most of them are not getting deals, even if they earn out, whatever. They're not getting second deals. But I could see how it could trap you psychologically. However, I mean, you can still choose after that big deal that flopped, you can still choose to do what a midlist, you know, failure would end up doing, which is either not publish books anymore, or publish different books, or, you know, change your quote unquote brand and your genre, all that kind of thing. Like,
no, that's fair enough. But, you know, if people disagree, I'm sure there's certainly a whole community on Reddit who will back them up.
Yeah. So come at me, Ed. Yeah. No, I really liked Ed. You can cut this if you want, but I liked him on a personal level, and he seemed on a professional level to really know what he's talking about, be really invested in his authors. So I am totally just kidding when I say come at me, because I do think he's a very fine agent, and I would, were I in need of the services he has to offer, I would not hesitate to query.
No, I would agree with that. He's a good guy. I have left Reddit though, because I just thought, actually, I'm just gonna walk away from this community forever. Because
yeah, that's fine.
I think I kind of reached the, Essa calls it the Keanu Reeves protocol. I reach a certain point where I've just decided, like, if people don't agree, you know, it's their funeral. Everyone has different experiences in publishing. It's fine, you know, live your truth. Just take care of yourself and make smart choices. So what is the hill you're willing to die on if you have one?
I mean, everything we talked about is that. We just did that.
Oh, okay.
The hill, I don't know. Do you have one? Do you want to go first? And then I'll try to think of what controversial thing I'll say next.
I do have one. We never got to do ours because we're always asking guests this. I do have one. And actually, I had so many. And I had to like whittle them down because I'm a very petty bitch. And everything from like people who don't use turn signals on roundabouts to how you make lasagna and all this shit. But in the end, I think there could only be one. Pettiest hill I would die on is that whenever someone mentions the allegedly inspirational story of J.K. Rowling and her 12 pathetic rejections, it should be legal for me to hunt them with a double crossbow. And just everything about that story bugs me. Because it's like it's everything that's endemic in publishing is kind of like in this story.
I have so many of these, Sunny. Oh my God.
Firstly, there's so much misinformation, right? Like everyone tells the story about, oh, she got rejected 12 times. Like that's a lot or something. The first problem with this is everyone is always talking about her rejections, not understanding that those rejections are publisher ones. And I think that J.K. Rowling fuels this. Obviously, your average person doesn't know the difference between an agent and a publisher. 12 is not a lot. But she gets online and she tells people, oh, yes, I had loads. I had so many rejections. And she carefully structures it. So when people talk about rejection, she mentions the one she got as that weird man, Robert Galbraith, her pen name that she read under. And she mentions the publisher one she got. And she mentions the first agent rejection she got. The thing she never talks about is her agent rejections. And that's because there just aren't very many. And you have to go back really, really far to 1997, the first Guardian interview with J.K. Rowling. Right. With the book finished, she approached an agent. I didn't know anything about agents, but I went to the library and looked up some addresses. Christopher Little was only the second one I wrote to.
Sounds like Richard.
Yes! She went to the library, she looked up agents at random. She got one fucking agent rejection. One! The second agent she wrote to at random said, oh yes, I'll have that manuscript. She went on submission once, got picked up by Bloomsbury, who's always touted as a small press, which I don't think is really fair. I was like saying Scholastic is a small press because they're not big five. But anyway, she got picked up by Bloomsbury, who were smaller, I suppose. And the thing with this article, right, is this article is written in 1997, which is the year Harry Potter came out. And it's titled, Debut Author and Single Mother Sells Children's Book for $100,000. So the year that Harry Potter came out, she then got a six-figure deal in the States, in no small part because Bloomsbury pushed her book, generated hype, and was doing things for her. And so if you retell the story with the facts are that, yeah, kind of like Richard, she picked agents at random. She signed with one almost immediately, went on submission once, sold really well, rocketed to fame. It's like, this is nothing like the story that she tells, but she's not fucking honest about it. Like, I don't mind that you succeed instantly. I mind that it's like, she's built herself into this myth of like hard graft, and she's fucking not, like, she doesn't know what lots of rejections look like. A lot of people ask me, like, why does it matter? When I point out the story, and it's like, well, firstly, it matters because I've met people in Facebook groups. Like, I remember talking to this lady who was basically in bits because she was like, oh, I have 14 query rejections. J.K. Rowling sent 12, and I have more than J.K. Rowling, and I'm still not published. It's like, yeah, because J.K. Rowling hardly got any. Like, you're fine. Like, 14 is nothing. Come back and you got 300. But the other part is that people don't care when you correct them on it. They don't care because they want to believe the myth that they too can do all the right things, get some rejections, be sad for 5 minutes, and then become a fucking billionaire. And
yeah,
I think her story and the myth behind her, which firstly is all part of the marketing, you know, Bloomsbury milked the hell out of like her story. The idea that you have to be a billionaire to be a success really grates on me. And that's the only kind of success that people see as success. And I think if your goal is to be the next J.K. Rowling, you should probably give the fuck up and go home because you've already failed and you will never be her and you are not her and none of us are. She's a once in a generation commercial success. We're not. But anyway, that's the hill I would die on. Give me a crossbow. I will come for people who tout this inspirational story because it's not inspirational. It's just...
Look out, Richard.
Do you remember Hot Potter Mania from when we were kids? Because you're the same age as me.
Yeah, Harry Potter Mania? Yeah, of course. I grew up in it. Yeah, same. You know, like I grew up reading the books. I grew up going in and seeing the films every, I think, Christmas. We'd usually go around Christmas.
Yeah, it was crazy.
See the films. We listened to the audiobooks on family road trips. Absolutely.
Yeah. I didn't because I hate Harry Potter, but that was a crazy cultural thing. But anyway, yeah.
It's not that it's not reproducible at all because, you know, she made a shit ton of money from the books, but especially once the movies came out, same thing ish happened with the Twilight books and Twilight movies. You know, I'm sure the Lord of the Rings estate has a shit ton of money now, and got much more money after the films than before the films. So it's a thing. I mean, it's a thing that happens where the films come out and make somebody a huge amount of money. But yeah, I mean, the factors that go into that kind of thing happening are just insane. You might as well play the lottery for sure.
Yeah,
that is a standard of success.
And this is like not even getting into all the other things that people are mad at her for, because like that's like several stops down the line, and I can't get, like, I'm still stuck at stop number one, which is like the bullshit story of her 12 stupid rejections. I don't know. It gets under my skin. But I do think she obfuscates it as well, because I've read some of her interviews since then, and I think she doesn't want to talk about the fact that she only had one agent rejection, so she is really careful in how she phrases it. And you, like, literally, you have to go back to this article that was only like in print, and in 2012 they reprinted a screenshot or like a digital upload of it or something. But it's I'll stop talking about it now.
That's really interesting to me. It's almost like the Trump thing where he claims to be a self-made man and really doesn't like it when his inheritance and loan or whatever he got from his rich dad comes up. Yeah, I don't understand why people struggle so much to acknowledge the good fortune that they've had. You know, why is that such a common theme?
Because people, particularly writers, believe in stories. And I think that comes back to this sense that your life is a story, and believing that if you do all the right things, you will get your happy ending, even though most people don't. And I think that's why so many people have a massive fucking, like, breakdown when shit goes badly wrong, because you feel cheated. You feel like the story that you thought your life was going to be just isn't, and it's just random events, and that's very scary. And I think even people who aren't religious, or perhaps even especially people who aren't, you know, when you're religious, you grow up believing that there's a plan and God is a plan and your life is following it. When you're not religious, you kind of believe that your life has like a point when it doesn't, and that your story is like unfolding around you when it isn't. Shit's just happening.
Yep.
That's my theory anyway.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, it does totally make sense. I mean, as far as my petty hills that I'd be willing to die on, that's like my whole personality, right?
Same. This is why I seriously thought about starting a podcast where you just talk about petty hills all the time.
It's the petty part that's hard for me, because I take everything very seriously.
No, really?
Yeah, I do. So
you're a universal basic income advocate, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I like more than UBI at this point is, although I am a proponent of UBI, but I like the idea of universal health care.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's a more immediate way to help people in desperate need, right? Not that UBI isn't a desperate need for a lot of people too, but universal healthcare would help people that are in desperate need, and it is life and death for most people. And in the event that it's not an issue of life and death, it's an issue of quality of life for a huge number of people. And the crazy thing about universal healthcare and people who oppose universal healthcare is that they don't want to pay for people who are making poor healthcare choices. But what they don't or poor health decisions, right? That affects their healthcare costs. What they don't understand is that we are paying that price now as a society, right? Mm. Like through healthcare costs that we, thanks to ACA, quote-unquote Obamacare, we are paying that cost through our healthcare premiums right now. We pay for people's emergency services if they can't pay. That's paid for anyway by the public right now. And we let things get to the point where it's this super expensive emergency instead of providing moral, ethical healthcare for people up front to prevent those horrible life circumstances and those horrible health outcomes that result in greater expenditures as a society. We're all paying that already. And beyond that, we have levels of parasitic corporations, in particular insurance, health insurance corporations, and then healthcare corporations with their enormous layers of admin that they yep. put on top of actual healthcare and in the prescription, the pharmaceutical space, you have PBMs that are siphoning off a whole bunch of money. So anyway, we could go in the U.S. This is targeted straight at the U.S. We could go to a single payer, which I know conservatives hate, and I was on that same page for a long time until I actually understood the issue. We could go to a single payer system that killed health insurance companies and still allowed for private practice and still allowed for a public-private partnership in healthcare. And we as a society would be saving tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars per year. Mm-hmm. We would be doing the ethical, moral thing of taking care of all the people in our society, thereby avoiding even more expenditure on the back end. And there is no reason to not have universal health care in the United States today. It is all purely political.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, just off the, you know, we're talking about J.K. Rowling. You know, she's English, well, Scottish, British, she's British. One of the reasons she was able to write is because she's unemployed. When she was writing her book, she could get on benefits. She could get health care while she was on benefits, and she could continue to exist, not very happily, but exist on those safety nets. And that applies to me. I can continue to live full time off writing for now. Harper drags us out another year. Please don't do that to me, Harper. But because I don't have to worry about healthcare, like, you know, I've got two special needs kids. They're not cheap children. So I'm all in favor of it. But I guess the other thing I would say is that I feel like, at the risk of sounding horrible, a lot of these people making anti-universal healthcare arguments, like my American grandparents, you know, they have lots of health issues like diabetes and stuff, which are to a degree self-inflicted. And they will stand there and be like, oh no, we don't want to pay for people's bad decisions. And it's like, you're literally on like Medicaid or whatever
that's
called.
You.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Like,
yeah, it's Medicare for old people. Yeah.
What's that? There's always this lady on Twitter that's talking about how everyone ends up disabled eventually. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing is like you don't have control over a lot of things like cancer. Mm. You don't have a lot of control in our current world over infectious disease, which more infectious diseases than people are aware of and willing to admit can leave people with chronic health issues. I've gone through several years of a post-survival issue myself. Yeah, it's just ludicrous to campaign against something like that. One thing I will say, because one of the things that people point out in the UK is that the NHS is hard to get appointments and the care can be substandard, whatever. There's a difference between single payer healthcare and getting rid of all the layers of admin that are just siphoning off money standing in the way of something like universal healthcare that could provide for people's needs when they have those needs instead of when it becomes an emergency, and between making public and having the government control all healthcare services, because that's the way it works in the UK.
No.
Right?
I mean, so that's one of the things. You can get private healthcare here if you want. My driving instructor had private healthcare, but even private healthcare here, because it's got to compete with the national version, is a lot cheaper. So she paid $220 a month, and she considered that expensive, which would be very cheap in the States.
Unbelievably cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she paid $220 a month, and she could go to the NHS if she wanted, but that covered her for things like basically really serious injuries where she needed like lots of hospital care and kind of paid her and stuff if she's out of work. So it was, I think, what is it? Some friends of mine that pay kind of like $1,500 a month in the States for their healthcare, and that would buy you like a fucking palace here. I mean,
that's not even. Yeah, I mean that's a reasonable plan. And I don't, I'm not necessarily against that setup because that does seem very reasonable in the competition between the publics to me. But my point is, you don't even have to put the government in charge of healthcare. You don't have to set up one single public hospital, just going to single payer, just providing the funds for people's healthcare in the existing healthcare service system would be an enormous improvement. And people say, well, then you'd have the government in charge of what gets reimbursed and what doesn't. You already fucking do that. All the healthcare, all the health insurance companies are already following reimbursements set by Medicare and Medicaid, for the most part, as far as I understand from my friends in the healthcare industry anyway. So yeah, there's just, honest to God, there's no excuse. And especially there's no excuse from, in the US, the liberal side, the Democrats, if they have the executive branch and if they have the legislative branch, there is no reason for them not to push through single payer healthcare other than laziness and I don't know what else, political machinations. There's no reason that we shouldn't have universal healthcare sooner rather than later. So there you go. There's another hill to die on.
Yeah, I'm sure people who came here for Publishing Talk are just like bowled over, but who cares? I mean, this is the thing. Like, I've reached this point where I don't care because we don't have sponsors. We can do what we like, and it doesn't matter if there's only like five people who listen. I just...
Sorry, people. We're just doing whatever the fuck we want now, and you're going to have to deal with it.
And on that note, you've been listening to the Publishing Radio Podcast with Sunny Dean and Scott Drakeford. Tune in next time for more in-depth discussion on everything publishing industry. See you later.